Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul, one of your co-hosts.
And I'm Maya Darren-Pohornby, your other co-host.
We're here today to talk with Steve Endicott, who's the chairman of Neural Voice, about how AI can transform customer experience and politics. Welcome to the pod, Steve.
Hi.
By way of introduction, Steve is the chairman of Neural Voice, which is a communication platform that develops AI voice assistants for businesses that want stronger customer relationships. We can very much relate to that as a growth marketing agency. These assistants offer personalized round-the-clock responses to ensure that no query or qualm from the customers goes unanswered. Love that.
Steve came to Neural Voice last year after decades of experience in travel tech, and he also chairs an AI incubator, Neural River, which now supports the spin-out Neural Voice. Just last month, Steve hit the headlines for standing in the general election to represent Brighton Pavilion as AI Steve. Brighton Pavilion was won by Sean Berry of the Green Party. While I would usually pass on my commiserations for the loss, the sheer amount of media attention this stunt attracted makes it difficult to see it as anything other than a masterful success for yourself and Neural Voice. We'll put AI Steve to one side for now and welcome real life Steve to the pod. We're very excited to have you here today. Welcome.
Oh, it's good to be here, guys. And let's have a chat about the world. So before we go into Neural Voice, let's just give you the background to Neural River. I had a corporate career. I've done my own startup since 2003, and I got very lucky to sell out at the right time. Holiday Taxis, I sold for $60.5 million in 2019. How lucky was that before the pandemic? I also sold my insurance business recently, so basically diversified and in a lovely situation where I can give more back. And one of the things I want to give back to the young people, I had a couple of very bright people come to me with an AI idea. I rejected it and said, guys, that's one bet in a massively exploding marketplace. I want to have an incubator. And how do we create an incubator so I have 10 bets in the next year? So we created Neural River, and we go out to the universities trying to recruit the top people by saying, one day a week you work on your own idea. If you get approved, half your time you work on your own ideas. And if we spin you out, you get between 10 and 40% of the business. Yeah, so you've got a shareholding stake. So don't work for the man, work for yourself. But crucially, we have 18 silver-haired old people like me who've been there, seen it, done it, and run businesses. And they sit on the panel to advise those people, but they also can earn sweat equity by helping them out with the business. And they also get first right to invest in those spin-out businesses. So we started 9 months ago. His first spin-out is Neural Voice, and we think it could be massive. And the reason we think it could be massive is the underlying principle is, why do you have to type? Why can't you just talk to the knowledge of the internet? And if you could talk to the knowledge of the internet, could you shape that into a business proposition that substitutes real human beings for 24/7 available assistants that can actually advise customers? And the only thing we've done, to be very clear, is it just doesn't go off to the internet. It looks at a business's personal database and tries to answer the question from that before it ever goes off to the knowledge of the internet.
I really like that. I mean, and this phrase, dialogue-driven AI, is I think, obviously very attractive. I'm someone who does a lot of writing. I sit a lot. My back and body has a lot to show for it in terms of like sitting and typing. And I often think, gosh, like, you know, when are we going to move to a model? We already have, obviously, Siri and Alexa and all that stuff. So you can see us moving that direction. And a lot of folks out there in our audience, they've had their fair share of like loopy conversations with online, you know, customer service chatbots and things like that. So wanted to dig into this aspect of dialogue-driven AI with you. And we'd love it if you could just kind of outline specifically, like explain how the tech works for us, take us through some of the use cases, and just, yeah, give our audience a bit more about Neural Voice and dialogue-driven AI, please.
So the first thing we've made a statement is that we won't lock down to one large language model because nobody knows which one's going to be the best in 2-3 years. And we just see that we're interchanging monthly as new things come out. We regard the language models like the engine of a car. We've got to build the car around that. So we'll build either Mini or Ferrari. We decide on the color, the shape, the steering wheel, sat nav, and that's the business case. But we can substitute the engine at any point. And we can have OpenAI in, we can substitute out with Bard, we can substitute in Lima, anything, at any point, because it will be interchangeable. But the fundamental starting point was AIs are different from Google. Google is a click and point where you put a short inquiry and then you do the research. The whole point about AIs is they're meant to be conversational, where you put in an inquiry and then you can refine down what you want. So you can do that typing, but it's actually much easier to do it if you have a conversation. And the AI prompts you to say, well, what are you actually looking for here? I'll give you an example. In the holiday world, we integrate to tour operators to say, right, give us access to your previous bookings. So we know Mr. Smith went to Mallorca last year with his two adults and two kids. So when we email out to Mr. Smith and said, where are you thinking about going next year? We start the conversation with, oh, you went for Manchester last year, Mr. Smith. Do you still want to go for Manchester? Oh, are you taking the two kids this year? They're now 13 and 14. So you can use AI to intelligently start a conversation. And the idea of that conversation is you're trying to move them along to say, not where did you go on a holiday last year, but where do you want to go on holiday this year? We gather all that information by having a conversation with them that tells them all about destinations. But at the end of the day, we're filling out a form that gets injected into the tour operator or retailer's database to say, this is where they want to go this year. That's so much more powerful than just guessing and sending out boring old emails with no direction, no promotion. So it allows us as a user case to really focus on where people want to go next year. So you're using that database of previous bookers, but you turn it from historical knowledge into future knowledge using a conversational AI.
That's really cool. And what are some of the bigger, the sectors where you've had the most take up, the most interest in this product?
Okay. So this is where AI is not good. AI is going to destroy millions of jobs. So we have to accept that, understand that, and move forward on that basis. For example, one of our political party's ideas is we're going to move to a four-day week by 2030 because there'll be less jobs around, because people will have more leisure time and some of the mundane jobs will disappear. The obvious mundane jobs are call centres. How many insurance call centres do you ring up? How many banks do you ring up? How many airlines do you ring up? And you can't get through. Whereas if you could call an AI-driven call centre, which is broadly 25% of the cost of a human being, so that's 75% cheaper, right? And you can call it 24/7 and you can scale from zero people to 10,000 in a second. Those are going to change the whole dynamics of call centers. They're going to change the whole dynamics of lots of the telecoms market. So we're focused on two particular verticals, telecoms in general and in travel, because of my previous background in travel. They're the two verticals. But again, we're trying to keep it simple because we want to do sell via resellers, because this is a race to the marketplace. Once you've got your idea out there, people can copy it. So you have to get out there, get customers, lock them down, provide value. Otherwise, you're going to be replaced by the next person in the AI queue. So therefore, having a B2B business model where you're selling via resellers and getting to the market quickly is really, really important in this sector. So we're focused on telecoms and we're focused on travel.
Makes sense, yeah.
To sort of create these conversational voice assistants, there are two levels of personalization that are required. Could you just explain how...
Yeah, let's tackle both those in turn. So the fundamental is that you want your own database of knowledge. So the easiest to do that and to do it scale is we just scan your website and every bit of information creates a database that the AI talks to. If you've got something wrong on your website, the AI will explain it wrongly, but most people don't. But the point is, and so rather than the customer having to go through that whole website to find out what's pages, what they want to know is, it lets you just ask a question. It's got a database and knowledge on that website. You upload your list of telephone numbers. You upload your appointment schedule. So there's an end result. And you say, what are you trying to achieve? What is the ultimate goal? And most people were trying to either on a website, trying to get a lead into a qualified lead into talking to a human being. So the person's having a conversation about the business. What do you want to know? Can I set up an appointment for you? Goes into a diary and diarizes that. For example, in travel, the key output is every single conversation is recorded, summarized and injected into whatever CRM you're using. So it would be at HubSpot, but we support 150 different CRMs. So it's about gathering the information, get it back into your CRM so you can then take action on it. So that action may be linking them to a web page to book a holiday. It may be set up an appointment for a human being to call them back. It may just be contextualize your next level of marketing. So what we're trying to do is make it out of the box so it's very quick to implement. And that's why scanning your website and uploading documents is the easiest way of gathering a database about the business effectively and quickly. So you're not actually going off the internet. You're just using the skills of the AI. So for example, we've got a speech to text layer where you talk and it turns into text, it injects it to the AI, researches the topic, brings it back in text, puts it back into human language, and all in 0.38 seconds. So at times we're too fast. We respond, and we've had to slow the system down because it's responding faster than the human being would do, which then meant it was interrupting the other human being talking to it. So it's a brand new technology. There's lots of learnings. There's a massive skill set about how you create the script and how the conversation goes. And we're learning every day.
Yeah. It's a really good segue into my next question, which is about like the biggest challenges that you've faced. You know, you mentioned this, like, you know, you got to sort of monitor the speed and make sure that the chatbot isn't talking over the humans there. There's obviously issues around sustainability, privacy, language. Just curious to unpack some of those issues that you face with Neural Voice and in the voice assistant industry and how you're tackling them.
The most difficult one is how to standardize it so you can work with multiple companies very easily. So it takes a lot of thinking about how do you get their data. Scanning the website is one way. Uploading sales packs, uploading Q&A from their websites, etc. That took a little while to work out. The technical side of it, we haven't had that many problems. So it's how you build the engine around the large language model and how you then make it understandable for people to go, oh, I want this, and develop the user cases where they go, oh, yeah, I can take that. So, for example, when we're talking to people, we don't talk about replacing the call center. We talk about 24/7 support outside of the normal call center hours. That's a lot easier to get into a business and say, oh, let's take out your entire call center. Yep. In the longer term, of course, we'll prove our concept out of hours. And then we'll say, oh, can we have some in-hour calls? And then we'll say, okay, do you want to internationalize? And by then, we can do multiple languages. But at the moment, for example, large language models support 42 different languages, but most of speech to text and text to speech are only English. So at the moment, we're focused on the English-speaking markets, but we think the biggest opportunity is outside of those markets, into the Eastern Bloc, into the Chinas, into those different marketplaces where you have to speak languages. If we can enable UK businesses to enter multiple marketplaces with AI support, so they can talk the right language at the right time 24/7, that's powerful.
I know sustainability and climate change is a big area of concern for you. So how are you addressing that in the rollout of Neural Voice?
Okay, so first of all, you've got to take the macro political environment. So in the UK, 48% of our electricity is generated by gas. That has to stop. We have to put carbon extractions on those turbines to make sure that we can still burn gas, but we don't put as much carbon into the air. We have to bring more nuclear into the environment because we have to bring more wind power into the environment. Because as we move to the AI, the demand for electricity is going to go through the roof. So therefore, we have to have clean electricity that doesn't damage the environment. Otherwise, we can't implement the AI. But the AI is coming. So it's a dual approach to say, look, we're going to have many more computers, many more chips. What's the implication of that? And the biggest implication is power, and we have to clean up our power sources. If you do that, AI is perfectly green. If you don't, it's highly polluting.
Yeah, it's an interesting like sort of dual challenge, right? If we want to like scale up this computing power then, and we want to do it sustainably, then we need to kind of scale up our renewable energy production.
It's not complicated. The UK at the moment, we have a plan for mini power stations. It's only where do you locate those? You locate those around the old major power stations. You locate them, for example, at airports because they're quite secure. So there's no excuse for not having more nuclear. It's just, it was a bad phase. Oh, we don't want nuclear. It is the cleanest sustainable energy that we have in the planet. Next is wind. Yeah, outside of that, you get into complexities. What we've got to do is stop burning gas. If we do burn it, have carbon extraction. And somebody has to pay for the carbon extraction. So we need a marketplace to say, how is that paid for?
Yeah, 100%. We've had a couple episodes now on the voluntary carbon market. We had John Leland from Kickstarter. They've done amazing work to kind of bring that company into that market and to, you know, have them be a player in the space.
So to return to AI Steve, your AI avatar who made an election bid in Brighton Pavilion, could you explain to our listeners exactly what you did and why?
Okay, so I became a Jolly Green Giant in 2019 when I sold my business and said, what am I going to do the rest of my life? And the answer was, actually, I want to start doing something to save the environment and the planet. So I bought my first Tesla. And in doing so, I realized that actually the biggest problem about electric cars was going to be charging. If you've got a home charger, and 68% of us do, you should be an early adopter. But for example, in Brighton, 80% have parking, which is on road, and they can't charge. So therefore, what are you going to do about that? Well, the answer is you've got to electrify your car parks. So an average car park is only 15% occupied at night. It's marketed mainly to shoppers and people traveling on trains, and nobody thinks about using it at night. We can use that 85% to put electricity into car parks and charge people's cars in the surrounding flat.
Just a quick question. What about the light poles that they have? Like, I've seen a lot of the light pole chargers on the street with the cars in the street. What about those?
They're good tools, but three times the price of electricity in a car park.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
So if you look at the underutilization of car parks at nights, it's local councils and government have got to do that, because they, on whole, either influence or control or own a lot of the car parks. So I thought, okay, so I want to do something. So I'll look at politics and I want to be an MP because I want to make a difference. So I went to the local Conservative Party and said, right, I want to be an MP. And they went, no. You have to stand to be a councillor first to show political activation. But I don't want to be a councillor. I was, okay, we'll put you in a region where you can't win. What? So you're going to put me in this place just to stand there and be a filler, which is an absolute waste of time. And you want me to knock on some doors. And then they took me around old people's home and said, these are people you've got to focus on, because council elections, you buy them coffee, they're the only ones that vote and we can get out. Don't think social media works. Don't think young people work. And I went, this is just rubbish. And some of the quality of the people in that community was just rubbish. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to do something about this. So if I can't change the Conservative Party, I'm going to launch my own party, Smarter UK. And the idea is we want to bring more business people into politics. And we want to bring it so it's easier to actually represent your community, because walking around Brighton and doing old-fashioned politics, nobody wants to talk to a politician. Yeah, 80% of the people run the other way as soon as you get a leaflet out. So we said, okay, how do we modernise democracy? So why don't we use social media? Why don't we make it 24/7 available? And we came up with the concept of using AI Steve. So I'd already invested in Newell River. We'd already launched in Newell Voice. We got drunk in the pub and they said, you know what? We could use Newell Voice to create a character that allows people to talk to it 24/7 about your policies. So we said, okay, that's a good idea. So, okay, but how are we going to create these policies? And the key thing is we wanted the residents and the voters to be the ones creating the policies and giving us the policy ideas. And that proved very effective during the campaign. We had lots of new policies because people come on saying, what about the bins? What about the taxis? What about this? What about that? And human beings create the policies, but we put them back to the creators to say, actually, is this what you meant? Yeah. And we let the creators talk to us about our existing policies to say, do they make sense to you? Yeah. So most creators are going to be politically motivated. You probably get some left wing, some right wing. Yeah. And we want to say, okay, let's make sure we don't have any mad policies by having a separate group, which we call validators. And we targeted the people commuting up to London because they had enough time to do it, where once a week they just vote on our policies to say, out of 10, a score of 10, does it make sense? And that's what we call the common lady, common man test, to say not only are we creating policies that the voters attend as they want, but we then test them against a separate group to make sure they're popular. Because if they're not popular, why are we doing them? And that was the whole concept about AI Steve. 24/7, available when you want to talk to it, nobody knocking on the doorstep. So you come out to the door in your slippers and your dressing gown, you don't want to talk to a politician. Talk to a politician when you want. But also not just at the time of election. Every 4 years they elect them, they bugger off to Parliament and do what they like. We went, that's not democracy. So we pledged that all of our MPs, and we're going to launch in multiple cities going forward, will always have to vote as they're told by their validators. So true democracy, every major decision they have to put to their validators to say, how do you want me to vote? If they don't agree with that vote, they've got a simple choice, resign or get out. Because it's democracy. And if 51% of people say that's what they want, that's what we vote for. So the whole point of people saying, oh, but then, you know, surely you just go in with the biggest communities and the biggest views. Well, yeah, that's democracy.
You're touching on one of the central, I think, facets of like democracy, which is like this difference between like trustee leadership and delegate leadership. And like the delegate is what you're talking about, like someone who actually takes the will of the people, be it the majority or what have you, to, you know, the governing body and implements it, versus someone who is a trustee who's trusted to kind of, you know, make the decisions and is considered well, not, you know, smart, knowledgeable and well informed. And so I think it's an interesting balance to strike there in terms of.
No, we want a combination of those. So to be clear, I will be setting most of the policies. A human being, the trusted person. but I will be validating them with the creators and the validators to say, are these policies what you want? So we don't expect community to make up all the policies. They just suggest areas that they want policies on, and then a human being creates those policy. A human being goes to Parliament, liaises, negotiates, and does all the normal thing an MP does, but he's in tune with his community because he constantly goes back to the community to say, is this what you want? It's a co-pilot that allows them to stay more in touch. For example, we had 20,000 calls over that two-week period of campaigning. Not only could I not handle that, right? All those calls are recorded, transcribed, summarised, and data mined. That's powerful. That really is. When I say, if I did get elected in the future, and we knew we wanted to get elected this time, when I go to Parliament, I'm going to Parliament armed with evidence of what my constituents want. Not theory, not bullshit, hard factual, data mined, science evidence.
Yeah. Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if other MPs or other, like, you know, candidates pick up this as like a way to just like run campaigns, to even run their offices once they are elected, in terms of like, how do I even begin to think about interacting with the population? I think that's really, so hopefully this is like, you know, it's not just like a stunt. It's like a nudge, like, hey, there's a better way to interact with the population.
We never regarded this as a stunt.
Yeah.
We knew we could not get elected because basically, the two problems, we're a first past the post. So we had to get awareness in a very small sliver called Brighton Pavilion. So we ended up getting international, national coverage, but translating that down to awareness in Brighton Pavilion. When we did the survey on the Monday before the vote, we did 1,000 people. We only had 8% awareness. So we're never going to win with 8% awareness because it takes years of awareness to create a party. We had a 3 to 4 week period and we knew we couldn't do it. But we had to start somewhere to demonstrate the concept and get other people interested in the concept. So the next elections are actually 4 years off. So we've got two routes. We created Smarter UK Party. And what we've learned is independent, is never going to work. We have to be national by 4 years' time, or we have to combine with another party. And we've not ruled either out. And we've also said we're not going to weaponize our technology. It's freely available to any party, because we're trying to improve democracy, not just get ourselves elected as an individual party. So if more people and more other parties are willing to use this to reach out, because democracy is broken in the UK, because the vast majority of people don't even know who their MP is. They don't know how to contact them. They don't talk to them. And the MPs get elected every 4 years and come back 4 years later and say, vote for me. And also, when you're voting at the moment, it's quite often the decision between leaders rather than MPs. If you spoke to most people and they choose a party, they're choosing it based on the leader, and a set of central policies, not what the MPs are. And if we can improve the link between the MPs so that it's a dual process, that'd be a massive improvement. The vast majority of the UK do not vote for their MP, they vote for the party and the party leader. And that leads to a broken system because you then don't have a direct contact with a local person. So it's great on national issues. What about the local issues?
What other applications do you see for the role of AI in sort of strengthening democracy in other ways?
I think you've got to be careful to actually restrict AI, because if you're not careful, a lot of what I don't want is millions of personalized adverts being sent out to individuals using AI just to persuade them to vote for a party when that's not actually the view. That's just what they want to tell them, that individual person. That's the danger of AI. So we've got to put safeguards around AI to say how you can use it in politics and how you can't. So communicating with your voters, I see, is a very positive thing. I can't see who can argue against it. Using AI to weaponize individual marketing down to a personalized view, highly dangerous. And we've got to work out what's good and what's bad. But that's the general world of AI. So if you look at AI, the biggest problem, it's like the genie's out of the bottle. It's like nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons will be made to control by detente because they're controlled by major national countries. AI is controlled by commercial businesses. Are you telling me Amazon and Microsoft and the others are going to sit around the table and say, how do we make less money? No, they're not. AI is out the bottle. It's out of control. It's up to governments to say, right, we've got to understand the power and the threat of AI, and we've got to put guardrails around it now and be really thinking about that. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to get into politics, is at least you'd have a group of people, hopefully in politics, who understand a little bit more about AI. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess in terms of something like AI, Steve, how do you think that sort of technology and sort of like implementation into people's everyday lives, how could that change narratives about AI and bring more attention and education to the sort of long-term ethical implications of AI?
AI, Steve, was a perfect user case for us to put out there. And again, you use the word stunt, I don't use the word stunt. As an awareness grower, it's been massive for Neural Voice, because it's a perfect user case, because we could say to people, talk to AI Steve, and it goes to our database of policies, and they go, oh, okay, I get that. Yeah, but it also has guardrails that says, go off to the internet, research a topic, come back and talk to the voter using the knowledge of the internet, but push them to give you what they want in that conversation. So it's a perfect example of how you can use a specific database and the general knowledge of the internet, and you can converse with somebody in 0.38 seconds. And it was interesting. If I went out to the market and said, oh, I've got a new version, a connection to the internet using voice, no PR company would take that. No newspaper would cover it. No TV company would cover it. So by creating a specific user case, which was interesting, which was AI Steve, we actually got massive awareness. But we wouldn't have got AI Steve right if we hadn't thought about what we were trying to achieve from a political party. It was a real political party, a real political objective that then created an AI with a real purpose that worked. And people got and went, okay, we like that. That was a great awareness, because then a lot of people rings up saying, look, this AI Steve business, could you do that for my business? Yep, yep. Just upload your Q&A here. Let's scan your website. We can create a character and they can talk to your business about your business. And people got it straight away. They wouldn't have got that without the example of AI Steve, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the future of AI, Steve, and you spoke about, you know, potentially collaborating with other parties, are you not worried that this sort of AI-driven discourse, how it could be used to sort of get the answers that certain people want to hear, how questions can be posed to get, you know, in an open way or a closed way, to sort of encourage validators, as you call them, to say...
Democracy.
Yeah.
Encourage democracy.
Yeah, so the or more influencing. People talk,
no, seriously, I'm going to challenge you back. Mm-hmm. At the moment, right, I bet a current MP maybe talked to 1% of his voters in the 4-year period they're in power. 1%. Right? If you're actually integrating and talking to many, many more voters, you're going to improve the power of democracy. We're keeping the decisions, because coming back to the blamed, we still need human beings. Human beings need to create the policies, because it would be dangerous to let AI create the policies on their own. Because then you could get bias, you could get all the other influences in. If you've got human beings who are then coming up with policies, validating it with creators and validating it with a separate group of validators, normal people, that's quite powerful. Mm-hmm. And it's improving democracy. I don't see the threat. Somebody said, well, hang on a minute, that means that the majority rules. Well yeah, that's democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you might get some biases in there. We might need the future to work out how to protect minority interests. But the basics of having more people communicating, more people involved in politics and running the country, has got to be a starting point. So another thing I get chucked at me, which I love, you're a shareholder in Neural Voice. That's corrupt. No, it's not. I'm trying to bring into politics my skill sets as a business, my knowledge as a business. I've declared my interest, which is minority interest in Neural Voice, and I can't make any decisions, anything around that area. That's not corruption. That's bringing real life business skills into the arena is what we're lacking in politics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How do we let business people involved in politics and still have a career in business, for example? Is that a bad thing? I don't think so.
Yeah. I think also too, like a lot of people are unfortunately used to businesses or like, you know, the wealthy class, like trying to restrict entry, you know, for people, whether it's like voting or whether it's, and you're talking about a business application that has the potential to expand and potentially deepen, you know, democratic voice in the space. So I think that like takes some getting used to. People are like, oh, wow, like this is actually a really interesting business application that, you know, can push MPs, push elected officials to A, talk to more of their people, and then B, in doing so, validate some of the policies that they, you know, that are being proposed in conversation with those elected. So I think that's really interesting and a bit of a different take.
Can I give you an interesting stat?
Sure.
In the US, the last 5 presidents have all been millionaires, dollar millionaires, before they got into politics.
Yeah.
It's a dollarocracy. You can't be a president unless you're rich.
Yeah.
Plutocracy. That's the American problem. Ours is just as bad. Of the last five prime ministers, all went to private school, apart from the Labour prime ministers coming in, all went to Oxford or Cambridge. And even Keir went to Oxford after he did his degree at law. So we're controlled by an elite of politicians quite often who've never done anything apart from politics. So we need to break that. So not only do we need to have a cycle where we're better communicating with our voters, we've got to get rid of the political elite and work out who are the best people to run our country. And quite often that's businessmen. But businessmen don't want to work full time and sit in the House of Parliament. So where's the compromise? How do we actually change things in the future? Because as we just said, you vote for the party, you don't vote for the individual MP. So is there a way we have more business people involved? That, here's a group of business people at Labour, here's a group of people, business people at Conservative or whatever. But you can't just have full-time MPs all the time because they don't have the business skill sets always to run a massive country. It's ludicrous. Let's put the people, the teachers, or the headmaster who's never been a teacher. Our current system is a little bit scary.
Yeah, I think.
If we can improve it, even by step by step. I'll give you another one, for example, paper voting and postal voting. So we do all of our banking online now. So we trust the banks with our security to provide entire wealth, but we can't vote online.
Yeah, that's a big one for
me.
So
in the short term, I actually think it's a really valid point because I don't trust our government systems. Electoral Commission, their website is appalling. So I don't trust the government systems to handle at the moment online voting. But we have to have some ambitions. And those next 4 years, how can we go into the next elections, 2028, and not allow people to vote from the convenience of their own home on their mobile phone? Come on. Again, that's democracy. Only 64% of the people across the UK voted.
That's a big one
and
for me.
And that's quite hard work. Let's make it easier for people to be involved in politics. And why is it every 4 years? For example, Brexit or any other major vote, why can't we have an online referendum? Well, we go back to the people to say, what do you actually think about this? Why has it only got to be every 4 years?
Yeah, we will have to end it there, Steve. I appreciate your time today. This has been an awesome conversation. Steve Endicott, the chairman of Neural Voice, and we talked about how AI can transform politics in particular, but also the customer experience. You did an amazing job with your moving the debate forward with AI, Steve, and trying to reshape some of the piping of democracy. So I just really want to appreciate your time today, Steve, and thanks for jumping on the pod.
Thank you very much. Last comment. Use AI for good. Less work, more leisure time, not a bad thing. But we have to balance how wealth is distributed amongst people. That's a consideration.
Love it. And we'll leave with our listeners, we'll leave you with some links to find Neural Voice and find out more about Steve in the episode description. And as always, please leave a review and a 5-star rating for us so we can have more great guests like Steve Endicott on the pod. Thanks again, Steve. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time, guys.